All right, JAL 2008. Hey, Anders.
How you doing, Charles?
Good. How are you doing?
Not too bad.
Excellent. So, introduce yourself. Everyone knows you, but, you know.
I'm Anders Heilsberg. I'm a technical fellow at Microsoft and the chief architect of C#.
Excellent. Hi.
I'm Guy Steele. I'm a Sun Fellow at Sun Microsystems Laboratories in Massachusetts.
Okay. And what's your specialty for those who don't know? What's your story?
I've been involved with computer languages for almost 40 years now. I love languages. I'm fascinated by how people use them to communicate with each other in computers. And I've had the good fortune to work on a number of interesting ones, including Common Lisp, Fanjava, and my latest language project is Fortress.
Fortress. Interesting. So is that related to concurrency?
Yeah, Fortress is specifically designed with parallelism in mind. We actually make it hard to write a sequential program in Fortress.
Nice. So that's sort of what we wanted to talk. I mean, Anders, in your keynote, you talked about, you had that great slide of the elephant in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And the elephant in the room is parallelism and concurrency and the many-core revolution.
Right.
So I kind of wanted to talk about that today because we have sort of different approaches to solve the problem. So.
Well, I'm not sure they're all that different, but you know, new languages versus trying to evolve existing languages, of course, end up being different solutions.
Sure.
Yeah, I had the elephant there because it's sort of metaphorically... It's the big thing in the living room that we've been trying to avoid, right? And we can't really anymore. But also, it was the six blind men and the elephant drawing or illustration, you know, where one is grabbing a leg and he thinks it's a trunk and the other thinks it's a rope and then he's got the tail. And it's just sort of metaphorically all the different kinds of concurrency that we have. And there isn't just sort of like one magic silver bullet that we need to do, and then we've taken care of many-core and multi-core. There are many different kinds of concurrency. Although I do think that the many-core, multi-core inflection point is at least shedding light on, or more light on a kind of concurrency that we haven't paid a lot of attention to before, this fine-grained concurrency where you want to break a single logical task into multiple workloads that you can then distribute on processors. It's sort of been that concurrency before. The traditional kind of concurrency is more like the time sharing kind of concurrency and processes that actually don't even know anything about each other, or threads that maybe have shared memory. But it's a coarser grain kind of concurrency. So
sure.
Yeah,
excellent. So let's talk a little bit about Fortress. Give us a little overview.
Okay, well, first of all, I'd like to say that I agree with Anders that all the different languages are drawing on a common pool of ideas, and we have different ideas about how to combine those ideas or give them different weight depending on the application. With Fortress, we were interested in making the language highly extensible so it could be grown by user community rather than under the control of the compiler group.
Mm-hmm.
And we were interested in emphasizing parallelism everywhere, and we also wanted to make an experiment with notation to take advantage of the growing availability of Unicode to allow the use of mathematical operators and see if we could make programming notation closer to mathematical notation so that for certain domains, such as computational physics, the notation might seem more familiar, thereby making it easier to debug programs.
Excellent. Well, that's clearly a language that Brian Beckman is going to love. He's a physicist at Microsoft.
Yeah.
He always talks about making languages more mathematical. That's his goal.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So it's not a general purpose language then, or is it?
Well, it could be used in a general purpose way. It's got an object-oriented framework underneath, mm-hmm. which we then use as an implementation layer. So that framework underneath is actually carefully designed to separate out a specific language design from the object-oriented underpinnings. So our hope is to use it as a framework for other kinds of domain-specific languages as well. But our first application was the scientific language.
Excellent. Very cool. And, Anders, we should talk a little bit about what you're doing specifically in your world, which is CLR and C#, obviously.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we we're coming at it from, we already have an existing programming language here called C#, and now concurrency is happening to us, and now we got to think about what that means. I think a lot of the work we did with C# 3.0 and Link is pretty relevant to the concurrency phenomenon, like having things like lambda expressions and the other stuff that we added makes it possible to build kinds of higher order kinds of APIs like matrix manipulation or query and set operations and transforms where you say to the API, here's my data, mm-hmm. and here's the function I want you to apply to it, now go away and do it, and then internally this thing can go away and do it in parallel. And one such example is P-Link, and a parallel implementation of Link, which is part of the parallel extensions for .NET. Now, of course, then doing that starts to bring into focus issues. Because we are an imperative programming language, we allow you to have mutation, and if you pass a piece of data and a function that has side effects to an API and you tell it to go do this in parallel, then God knows what kinds of results you're going to see, and they're probably not the ones you expect. So we're sort of lacking mechanisms in the language to control side effects or to call attention to them. It sure would be nice to have language support for pure functions and a formalization of immutable data and possibly support for isolation in some form where you can sort of, in the compiler, reason about whether an object has been revealed to anybody else, and as long as it hasn't and you're just dealing with it in a local variable, then actually it is safe to mutate it because no one else knows you're doing it, and so the side effects are not visible. And so those are things we think about. Those are not things that are in the language currently. Those are things that we'd like to have in the language. Now, of course, we need to find ways to put them in.
Sure.
And it's a non-trivial problem when when the whole world has been taught to program in a fashion that is somewhat incompatible with where we need to go. And that's the big challenge right now.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's not like this is really that big of a surprise, is it? I mean, you being in the sciences, mathematics, mathematical computing, there's always been a need for a lot of concurrency, obviously. So now all of a sudden it's a big problem. It's interesting because it seems like it's partially hysteria or fear. Because you guys have been this for so long, you realize that writing concurrent code is something that you should always be able to do. But why are we where we are? How's that for me spitting out a question to you?
Sure. Well, first of all, you pointed out there are two kinds of reasons to want concurrency. One is because you're actually dealing with concurrent events in the real world. You're doing transaction processing. You're on the web with a web store, and you're serving orders to hundreds of different customers. You've got to keep your database consistent. Their concurrency is an essential part of the application. The other kind of concurrency is you'd be perfectly happy to have one processor if you can't make one processor that fast. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, if only we could build an exahertz processor, then the supercomputer guys in the national labs would be perfectly happy. Well, they'd still want to buy 1,000 of them and strap them together, but, you know, if they could afford them. But they don't really want to program concurrently. They have to in order to get the performance they need. And we are being forced into performance now because of the advent of multi-core computers being cheaper than single processors. Mm. It's actually hard to buy a laptop without more than one processor in it now. Mm-hmm. So concurrency is now in our faces. Whether we want it or not, we've got to come to grips with it. So we need a way to write down not just what a program does, but also to provide information about where, not so much that this has to be concurrent, but that I don't care whether it's sequential or not. Mm-hmm. And if the programmer can just provide a little information to the language processor that it's okay to use parallelism here, then we can do a much better job of execution.
So in that sense, then, you could have, in general purpose languages that already exist today, you could just decorate code and say, run this. This can be run parallel. But that gets a little tricky, doesn't it? Because do all developers know when?
Well, so, that is exactly the problem right there. Because you can... Yes, you can say, just please go ahead and run it in parallel, but are you really sure that it's safe to do so, right? I mean, it may be that in your code you actually are being a good boy and you don't have any mutation or shared state, but perhaps you're calling APIs and perhaps you don't know what goes on in those APIs, like standard functions out of the framework. And it has to be all the way down, you know, sort of the ability to reason about whether... So pure functions can only call other pure functions and so forth. So you need transitivity in that analysis, right, in order to do it right. Now one of the things that are interesting here in this aspect, and one of the things that's been talked about a lot at this conference too, is functional programming, because functional programming promotes a style of programming where there is no mutation and there are no side effects, and therefore it is literally by definition safe for concurrency, because if you have the expression f of x plus g of y, well, since you know there is no shared state between these two. You can, and then since they do not depend on each other's result, you can go evaluate them both in parallel and then operate on the results thereafter. That's not to say that functional languages just automatically parallelize. There are all sorts of tricky issues in doing this. But at least that style of programming is much more compatible with what we'd like to do. And that's why we're so interested in looking at functional extensions, because they come along with this nice property that they can parallelize.
Mm-hmm. And so why not just, you know, encourage developers to just drop imperative languages and just start and just become functional programmers? Learn Haskell or learn some functional programming language and change your tool set.
Well, there have been at least four different talks at JIO yesterday that urged that. Anders gave such a talk, I gave a talk, Venters gave a talk, and Eric Meyer gave a talk, each in their own way, saying there are advantages to functional programming that will become more important in the concurrent world. But sequential programmers have a lot of investment in very interesting skills that work very well for sequential programming. And it takes a change of mindset. I mean, consider a guitar player, classical guitar player, who's gotten very good at finger picking, and he can play one note at a time very rapidly. Mm-hmm. And he can move this hand very quickly with a pick, and he can move, you know, this hand very quickly with the fingers. Mm-hmm. And you point out to him, you know, you can play more than one string at once. You know, there are these things called chords. But that's a very different style of music. Mm-hmm. And it takes a great deal of investment and practice to learn that other style of music.
Okay.
And, you know, and it's not that one is better than the other necessarily. It depends on what your goals are. Mm-hmm. And this is why we have different computer languages, because there are trade-offs between time, space, education, what it is you're trying to achieve, what your hardware resources are available.
Absolutely.
And but if you want a particular kind of goal, parallelism, you know, chords are the way to go. You know, get in more than one note at a time.
I think it's also worth mentioning that pure functional programming is probably not suitable for a lot of the problems that we want to solve. I mean, there are all sorts of efficiency issues with pure functional programming. You know, a quick sort written in the functional way versus a quick sort written in the imperative way has a very poor performance characteristic. So there are problems we better solve in the imperative style. And really what I think we're trying to say in these various talks about functional programming is that there's something good here, and if we can at least have islands of purity in functional style, and then be clearer about where the mutation occurs and where the side effects are by in a sense switching the default to be more functional, but actually using hybrid programming styles and C sharp, for example, with its extensions is now a multi-paradigm language, you know, and F sharp is a language like that comes at it from the other side, you know, essentially being out of a functional family but with imperative extensions. So it's a happy medium. I don't think the answer is at the extreme, and I don't think that we can just like toss all the software we've already written and go write it in a functional style. Because as I sometimes joke around with functional programs, you know, a program that is entirely side effect free can really have only one effect, and that is to make your CPU hot, right? Because you can't even print the result. That's a side effect, because you got to flip bits on your display to make people see the result, right? So there has to be some side effects. It's just a matter of controlling them better.
Controlling side effects.
Yeah,
exactly. I agree completely.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's interesting. One of the things that's interesting, though, is if you add more and more to a language, one could ask, is the language going to get too big? Right? So if you merge in all these functional constructs into general-purpose programming languages that are imperative, like C-sharp or Java, at what point, as language designers, do you say, whoa, step back, this is getting too big, and how does that affect programmers that now have all these features in this giant programming language? And so, you know, it's an interesting question, because you guys are, how do you make those trade-offs?
Well, that's a very, very good point. Language designers do have to make decisions about what to leave out as well as what to put in. Mm-hmm. So as an example of something that we are currently leaving out of Fortress, we no longer have line printer controls in our format statements, for example. I think a very old example from Fortran.
Okay.
You know, there are things that were important along the way that we have dropped, and because we have other concerns.
Yeah.
We're no longer as concerned about, I/O formatting concerns seem to come to the fore. We're no longer as concerned about binary coded decimal representations as we used to be. Mm-hmm. Not that those are unimportant; they still are used in business applications, but we just don't pay as much attention to them in language design anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And we pay more attention to things like talking to the web.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think as you design a language, or rather, as you evolve a language, you end up sort of accruing baggage, if you will, like old features that are no longer relevant or as relevant as they once were, or are slightly duplicative of newer features that you put in, and you know, all languages eventually sort of cave in to their own irrelevance, if you will, in that the majority of their features are no longer relevant to the kinds of problems that we're solving. I'm not meaning to imply that we're there with C#. It's still a young language, I think, with lots of, you know,
room for growth,
yeah. but this is the natural cycle of programming languages, and this happens to everybody. And in a sense, it's our job to prolong the lifespan of the language as long as possible, and be as judicious as possible about what we add to the language, because every new feature ages the language a bit. You know, as you evolve it, right? And you can only do it for so long.
True.
Yeah.
I can give you, here's another example of fads in programming languages. In about the early 1970s, there was a big debate about whether the Go2 was a good thing or not. That stemmed out of Dijkstra's letter in 1968. There was a big debate in 1972 at an ACM conference. And people were really concerned, what are the right control structures to program with? And some said, oh, you can't get rid of the Go2. And others says, yes, we will get rid of the Go2, but if we get rid of the Go2, then we need a much richer set of control structures. What are the right ones? They said, well, we need loops. Well, what kinds of loops? How many? We'd want while do while. What kinds of for loops? Do we need loops that go around n times and a half? And if so, what is the right way to break out of the middle of that half a loop? A tremendous amount of energy went into exploring alternatives. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of settled out, and we picked three or four, and those are the ones that got pulled forward into C and into Java and C#, and all those. And they're pretty much standard now.
Mm-hmm.
But if we had kept everything from the past, we would have 12 different kinds of loops instead of just three or four. And we decided we don't need that anymore.
Excellent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, I mean, one of the things that's fascinating me, as I've covered this conference for a while, and at Microsoft doing a lot of interviews with language people, is how is it that certain languages get adopted? I mean, is it luck? What is it? Is there 2,000 languages out there? Some of them really interesting that could solve problems today that people face, but they don't use them. So how, you know, I'm very interested in how languages get adopted and become the de facto status quo. What are your ideas on that as language?
Well, I think
people.
I think there are maybe some conditions that have to be true for new languages to succeed. Often there needs to be an inflection point of sorts. I mean, if you look at Java, for example, was the notion of, you know, apps running in a web page, right? Or the internet being your runtime, right? There has to be a need, a perceived need for something new, you know, like something has gotten too hard or too complicated, or people are not succeeding, you know, and like that's where, you know, all new languages sort of tend to move to up-level abstractions and make it simpler, or allow you to think at a higher level that is more relevant to your particular problem. I think there has to be a strong user community in place that wants to adopt the language and will sort of build the ecosystem around it. Do you know what I mean? So there are many, many things. I don't know that there's a clear formula that if you do this, this, and this, you will succeed. You know, sure. I couldn't give you the exact ingredients.
It's interesting.
Yeah, so sometimes the phrase killer app is used. And they say that to get a language adopted, you need a killer app for it. In other words, the application that justifies its existence. And the classic example of a killer app was that for C, it was Unix. You know, C made it possible to port Unix, and people wanted Unix. And so C stuck around and got used for all kinds of other things. But you need some important application to sustain the ecosystem for the language. Mm. Now, not every language needs a big ecosystem. You know, it's possible to invent tiny languages and invest a fairly small amount of effort. And that's why there's so many little scripting languages, is you can throw a scripting language together in a couple of days if you know what you're doing. Yeah. Now, whether it's better than any other existing scripting language, you know, maybe it was just easier to invent a new language than to try to port an existing one. Uh-huh. But it probably won't get a very big user community that way. You know, in order to attain a big user community, you need a big investment. Mm. And then there has to be a reason that you're solving a problem for that larger number of users.
And so, I mean, in that vein, the reason that we find JavaScript so extraordinarily successful, pervasive on the web, was because it was a language designed specifically for use in adding functionality to web pages. I mean, is that a fair assessment? I mean, the language itself, as language designers, I'm sure you find it to be somewhat strange.
Some language was needed, and Brendan Eich, you know, said, well, let's make a scripting language. Mm-hmm. And it was actually one of those things that kind of started as a small ad hoc thing and continued to grow.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it solved the need, and people saw an advantage in making a standard, and it got widely adopted.
Excellent.
We could have ended up with, you know, 50 scripting languages on the web instead of, you know, one or two primary ones, and then we'd be in a very different world.
Oh, there were multiple in the beginning. But then one gen tends to win out, you know, for a variety of reasons. And of course, what sustains it today is the fact that it is, you know, you can code to that least common denominator called JavaScript and expect it to be present in any browser,
right?
And so that now is like this self-reinforcing cycle, you know.
Mm-hmm. So do you ever think, I mean, unlike physics, I mean, there's never been this sort of notion in, well, I can't, you know, speak with such, but I'll say it anyway. So I'm going to say, you know, there's not this notion of a singularity in programming languages where there's this one amazing programming language that you're searching for. I mean, why should I, as a developer, have to know five languages to get one project done? For example, if I'm writing a book, wouldn't I rather write it in English and have a chapter in English, a chapter in French, a chapter in Danish? So is there this kind of thinking in your world where wouldn't it be great if we had one programming language that didn't just run everywhere but solved all the problems in the whole world?
If there was one language to end all and we were done, the reason for that would be because we were done evolving computers and we had invented the last computer and the last, you know, and we could all go home, right? So I don't think so. I mean, as long as this industry continues to evolve at the clip that it's been evolving, and all indicators are that it will, mm-hmm. there will be a need for new languages because there will be new paradigms, and then things will shift around, and there will be things that we have not thought about before. I think also with you said multi. Did you mean to imply multi-paradigm programming? Why do I need that as opposed to? Well, I think that's just, you know, in a sense, that's a function of the evolution, right? I mean, a language is multi-paradigm because, you know, there were languages before it and you pick from those, mm-hmm. you know, so that is sort of a natural effect of the way languages evolve is that they end up picking pieces from other languages and then in a sense become an amalgam of stuff.
Okay, so that the better analogy would be an artist's brushes, as opposed to the chapters in a book or the strings in the book that I was trying to allude to. But I guess it's just an interesting thing because I see, especially in, you know, in our camp, Anders, in the C# and the CLR world, we are investing a lot of time in the libraries and the runtime, and then our languages are just small wrappers on top of it. So if you have the really big runtime and base class libraries, the importance of the languages seems to decrease. Is that true? Or,
well, I mean, I certainly, and I observed that in my keynote, how, you know, it used to be 25 years ago, the learning curve for a programming language was really what dominated the total learning effort that you had to put into moving to some other programming experience. But now, you know, programming languages have evolved some in those 25 years, but frameworks and tools have just gone amok, right, and are now 1,000 times larger, depending on how you count, but you're certainly if you count number of entry points in the frameworks. And so it is, so yes, in a sense, the language is a smaller part of the learning curve, but also there's so much leverage to be had by building on an existing platform like Java or .NET that mm-hmm. that it's almost foolish not to, because you have to go reinvent so much stuff mm-hmm. that has probably nothing to do with what it is you're trying to accomplish with your language, right? So mm-hmm. so it's just a matter of leverage, I think.
Interesting. You have a perspective on that?
Sure. The reason we need more new languages all the time is because the computers don't stay put, as Andrew said. The trade-offs keep changing. What we want to do with them keeps changing. And another reason you can't have a single language is because a language that's general enough to support anything isn't specific enough to be efficient for any particular purpose. Yeah. And we depend upon being able to use specialized notation for the things that are common in the domain you're trying to tackle. And if you make those things common, then that language will not be appropriate for some other area of programming or some area of concern where those are not the common things. Mm. And English is not a single language either, nor is any natural language. We tend to overload words and use them in very special ways in particular contexts. If I say those chips are all broken, that means one thing in computer science. It means another thing to a potato chip manufacturer.
Or a gambler.
You know, so, exactly. You know, the word chip means a lot of different things.
Okay.
And when I'm designing a programming language, I have to think, you know, what is it worth spending the square brackets on? Mm. You know, the at sign, the sharp sign. I can make those mean particular things. And once I've used up the easy-to-type characters, then I've got the less easy-to-type characters, in the case of Unicode, or no other characters if I'm stuck with an ASCII keyboard. Mm. But, and I've got uppercase and lowercase characters to work with. What am I going to spend the uppercase letters on? You know, a language designer makes very careful decisions about what to make especially easy to say in a particular problem area. Hmm. You know, Perl used the at sign and dollar sign in very particular ways, and those are very cute, but you can't just import that in another language that uses those characters in some other ways.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And the same is for the names of things. If I say draw is going to mean draw a picture on the screen, I can't also use it to mean draw a gun, or that's a classic example.
Sure.
You know, there's going to be confusion.
But I guess that where the notion of DSLs come in, right? So I guess what I'm trying to do is trying to go off into left field and think outside, way outside of, I guess, the box or sanity. But I mean, if you had a general purpose default base language and then you could spin off DSLs on to be the fortress type DSL, that's a small, highly specific thing, but you had this base, then you would have, you know, essentially could eliminate this whole notion of incompatibility. I mean, the interoperability would just be there.
Yeah.
Because everybody's using the same base language, and they spin off DSLs on.
Sure. And I think, in a sense, you know, what you're saying is not really all that different from what's happening right now. I mean, when people talk about DSLs, at least when they're talking about internal DSLs, if we're using Martin Fowler's terminology, then internal DSLs are really just fancy APIs and usage patterns of those APIs. And sure, APIs mix, and we all know how that happens. Now, syntactically, it may be a little bit too clunky. You know, it's like we have these fluent interfaces with dots, dot foo, dot bar, dot x, dot y, and that we sort of dot together. And if we squint, we can sort of see some little domain-specific language in there, but it might not be as pretty as we'd like. And some languages, experiment with method calls that use infix notation and become operators, like in Scala, that's how you define new operators. So you just say blah, and then my operator foo, and then that's actually a method called my operator that takes blah and foo as two arguments. But there's a limit to how much you can do with these patterns, and I think that's something we're exploring these days. You know, how far can you take it? I could sort of wish, for example, that link comprehensions, query comprehensions, or query expressions, or, you know, the syntactic veneer that we put on top of link could just be defined, you know, such that you could go define the API and the language extensions to go along with them all as a neat little library, right? Mm. But it turns out to be a little bit tricky because the kind of rewrites we want to do there with range variables and make lambdas out of them and whatever, and there's some not so simple things going on that they look simple, but if you look at it, you kind of end up realizing, wow, I would actually have to give the domain language designer access to the full AST of this compilation and allow them to transform it and whatever. And now you're sort of talking about dropping the big bomb. Because once you do that, you can never change anything, right? Because the nice property of programming languages now is that it's a syntax and some semantics that are written down. As long as you adhere to that, you can build a compiler any which way you care to. And you can tear it apart, and you can make it parallel inside, and you can write in another language, and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But once you open up the kimono there and allow people to plug in anywhere in your compiler, you're also painted into a corner. And so it's just one of those, I don't know what the answer is. I love to do it, but I'm afraid of doing it too.
That is a concern, you know? And we actually are trying to tackle that in our fortress framework.
Uh-huh.
And dangers do lurk there, and it's very difficult.
Yes.
We haven't figured out the complete story yet.
Yeah.
So we are going to give user libraries access, maybe not to the AST, but to an AST.
Right.
And we may not get it right, and we have to live with some bad decisions.
Right.
But
or once you get it right,
or not maintain compatibility, or get it right, if we're lucky.
But
you're right; it's a hard problem, and we've chosen that as part of a research effort. And you've chosen not to do that because you want to invest your effort in other areas, and that's fine.
Yeah,
that's
but
another
you know,
reason
hey,
to different languages.
This is again exactly the point here is that we all learn from each other in this industry. You know, someday we'll figure this out.
Absolutely.
But we haven't quite figured it out yet.
Yeah, I was paying attention to your talk about F-sharp, and I tend to swipe a couple of ideas.
Excellent. I mean, that's actually, it's one of the great things about this conference. I mean, here we are, you're both language designers, but you target different, groups of developers, work for different companies, competitors even. Mm-hmm. Yet, that doesn't matter here, because in the end, you're language designers, and that's what's important, and the information sharing is... It's great.
Yeah.
I think it's a really wonderful thing.
It's a great thing. I agree.
Absolutely. So I guess the final question I'll ask, or one of the final ones, I never really end when I say I'm going to end, but at this point, where are we going to be in 10 years? Now, specific to, do you think we're still going to have the concurrency problem? Is it going to be an elephant, or is it going to be a little mouse that runs around that we don't worry about anymore?
Well,
what do you think the next problem is going to be?
Well, we will have tamed the elephant a bit more, I hope. I think, you know, I'll sort of make one point, which is languages evolve a lot slower than people tend to notice, you know. If you go back 25 years and you look at where we are now, it's not, yes, a lot has happened, but it is nowhere near... You know the accelerated growth that we've seen in the hardware, or in the size of the libraries, or even I'd say in the capabilities of the integrated development environments and so forth. So languages are like it's, you go in slow, measured little steps. You know, so we will make some inroads on like maybe extensible syntax like we talked about on. Other kinds of declarative programming. We will have become probably more functional in our imperative languages. We maybe will have abilities to reason about purity and immutability better and isolation, you know, in our languages. But don't expect the world to completely change in 10 years. You know, it's not gonna.
Cool.
Yeah, I'd say that in 10 years from now. F-sharp and Fortress will be considered mainstream languages, maybe even boring old languages, let's have something new. In the meantime, Java and C and C++ and Fortran will still be around. Mm-hmm. And we'll be up against some kind of new problem. If I had to guess what the next problem is after concurrency, it's probably going to be power consumption. Mm-hmm. Energy consumption is just beginning to be a severe concern for computation as the computers are getting more and more power hungry. And those concerns may seep into the languages in some way. I hope not, because that's another complexity I'd rather not deal with.
Sure.
You know, I didn't want to deal with concurrency either, but we have to. And that's part of the trade.
So we're going to have, like, fast ints and slow ints that use less power.
It's entirely possible. Instead of talking about 8-bit ints and 32-bit ints, we'll talk about cheap ints, you know, and expensive ints or something. Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's possible.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I was at the V8 talk today. And that's the new JavaScript virtual machine. It's, I guess it's sort of a virtual machine.
It's a virtual machine. Doesn't have an IL, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it takes text and converts it to machine code.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it was interesting because he mentioned something about saving energy. V8 would decrease CPU usage because it's more performant. I didn't quite understand that. Did you get what he meant?
Sure.
What he was talking about?
When something runs fast, that means it executed fewer instructions to do what it did, and therefore it had to use less. It used less power because the CPU did not have to be on and active for as long, right?
Interesting.
Okay. So, I mean, that's the thing about like a slow JavaScript program. That doesn't mean that the CPU is running slower. It just means that it's running more instructions that don't do useful stuff.
Okay. So that's an energy saver.
In theory, yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. So just make super, super efficient compilers.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, hey, thank you for your time. And it was great to meet you. Absolutely. Yeah. Enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thanks.
Thank you.